A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking what actually happens when you default on a mortgage and lose the house. Step by step, not the headline version. What does the eviction day look like? Can the bank take your furniture and your laptop? And once the dust settles, what stops those people from ending up on the street? Especially when bankruptcy gets tangled up in the picture. It's one of those questions where the real answer is weirder and more procedural than most people imagine.
The moment the bank takes your house isn't a single dramatic scene. It's a slow, procedural dismantling. A stack of mailed notices, a county filing, a sheriff's deputy with a clipboard, and a locksmith. And most of what people believe about it is wrong.
Where do we even start?
Let's lay out the three phases first. Because the timeline is the skeleton, everything else hangs on. Phase 1 is pre-foreclosure. That's roughly the first 120 days after you miss your first payment. Phase 2 is the foreclosure auction itself, which usually happens around day 121 or later depending on state law. Phase 3 is post-sale eviction, which is the 30 to 90 days after the auction where you're physically removed. And the terminology varies. In the UK, it's called repossession. In the US, it's foreclosure. But the underlying legal mechanism is identical. The lender is enforcing a security interest in real property. Your house was the collateral for the loan, and now they're taking the collateral.
Three core questions, then. What physically happens during repossession? Can the bank take your stuff? And what happens to the people afterward?
Let's walk through phase 1. You miss a payment. Usually it takes 30 days before anything formal happens. The lender sends a demand letter. It's not a court document yet. It's just a letter saying you're in breach, here's what you owe, here's the late fee, and if you don't pay within a certain window, they'll accelerate the loan.
Accelerate meaning the whole balance becomes due, not just the missed payments.
That's the nuclear option in the contract, the acceleration clause. Once they accelerate, you don't just owe the arrears, you owe the entire remaining principal. And practically nobody can pay that, which is why it's the trigger for foreclosure. After the demand letter, the lender files a notice of default with the county recorder's office. That's the first public record that the foreclosure process has started. And it kicks off what's called the reinstatement period, a window where the borrower can cure the default by paying all the missed payments plus fees and costs.
How long is that window?
Varies by state. In California, for example, it's 90 days from the recording of the notice of default. In Texas, which is a much faster foreclosure state, it can be as short as 20 days. But here's what most people don't realize. During reinstatement, the clock is ticking, and every month you don't pay adds another month of arrears plus another month of late fees. The amount you need to cure keeps growing.
It's a treadmill that accelerates while you're standing still.
That's not an accident. The system is designed to give you a chance, but it's a chance that gets more expensive the longer you wait. If the reinstatement period expires and you haven't cured, the lender schedules the foreclosure auction. They have to publish a notice of sale, usually in a local newspaper, and post it on the property itself for a set number of weeks before the sale date. And this is where the auction mechanics get interesting.
I'm listening.
The lender sets something called a credit bid. It's typically the outstanding loan balance plus all the accrued fees, costs, and attorney charges. On auction day, the property goes to the highest bidder. But here's the thing. In the vast majority of cases, the only bidder is the bank itself. They bid their credit bid amount, nobody else bids higher, and the property becomes what's called REO, real estate owned, meaning it's now a bank-owned property.
Why doesn't anyone else bid?
Because the credit bid is usually close to or above the market value of the home. If you owe $300,000 on a house worth $280,000, the bank's opening bid is $300,000 plus costs. No third-party investor is going to bid above market value, so the bank takes it back. And that's how most foreclosures end, not with a dramatic auction, but with the property quietly transferring to the lender's REO department.
The bank doesn't take the house in the dramatic raid. They buy it back from themselves at an auction nobody else attends.
And now we get to phase 3, the eviction. After the auction, there's typically a post-sale redemption period. In some states, it's 0 days. Once the sale is recorded, that's it. In others, like Michigan, it's 6 months. During redemption, the borrower can still reclaim the property by paying the full sale price plus costs. Almost nobody does, because if you couldn't pay the arrears, you can't pay the full balance.
Then the sheriff shows up.
The bank files what's called an unlawful detainer lawsuit. It's a summary eviction proceeding, much faster than a regular civil lawsuit. The borrower gets served with a complaint. In something like 90% of cases, the borrower doesn't file a response. They've already moved out, or they've given up, or they don't understand they have the right to contest it. So the bank wins a default judgment. Then the court issues a writ of possession, and the sheriff's department schedules the lockout.
Walk me through the lockout day.
The sheriff's deputy arrives, usually with a locksmith and sometimes with a moving crew. They knock and announce. If nobody answers, the locksmith drills the lock. The deputy enters first, does a sweep to make sure nobody's inside, and then posts a notice on the door, typically a 24 to 72 hour notice, stating that the property has been repossessed and that any remaining belongings are now legally classified as abandoned property.
That's a loaded legal term.
It is, and it matters. Once the property is posted as abandoned, the former owner typically has a very short window, sometimes as little as 48 hours, to contact the lender or the sheriff and arrange to retrieve personal belongings. If they don't, the lender can dispose of everything. And this is where we get to one of the biggest misconceptions out there.
The stuff inside the house.
The stuff inside the house. Most people believe the bank can seize and sell everything. Your couch, your TV, your grandmother's china. That's not true. A standard mortgage is a security interest in the real property in what are called fixtures. Fixtures are things permanently attached to the house, built-in appliances, the water heater, installed carpeting, light fixtures, the furnace. Those are part of the collateral.
The bank gets the chandelier, but not the dining table.
Ordinary household goods. Furniture, electronics, clothing, personal effects are not collateral for a standard residential mortgage. The bank cannot seize them to satisfy the debt. However, there's a huge practical caveat.
Of course there are.
If you leave your belongings in the house after the lockout and you don't retrieve them within the abandonment window, the bank can dispose of them. They're not seizing them as collateral. They're disposing of abandoned property. Legally distinct, practically identical outcome. And if the bank has to hire a hauling company to clear the house, they can bill the former owner for the cost.
You lose your stuff not because the bank has a right to it, but because you couldn't physically move it in time.
Many people in foreclosure don't have the money for a moving truck or storage or a new place to put everything, so they leave things behind. Not because the law says the bank gets it, but because the logistics of poverty make retrieval impossible.
Let's put some numbers on this timeline. How long does the whole thing actually take?
In Maricopa County, Arizona, which was the busiest foreclosure market in the U.S. in 2025, the average time from first missed payment to sheriff lockout was 287 days, according to RealtyTrack data. That's about 9.5 months, and Maricopa is a relatively fast jurisdiction.
What about somewhere slower?
Ireland is a good contrast. The average repossession timeline there is 18 months. The reason is constitutional. The Irish Constitution includes strong property rights protections, and the courts require a much more extensive process before ordering an eviction. So in Dublin, you might get 1.5 years. In Phoenix, you get 9 months. The experience of losing your home is profoundly different depending on where you live.
Let's get to the bankruptcy question, because this is where it gets complicated.
Bankruptcy changes the game, but not in the way most people assume. Here's where it gets complicated. When you file for bankruptcy, let's say Chapter 7, the moment you file, something called the automatic stay kicks in. It's a federal injunction that halts all collection actions. Foreclosure proceedings stop. The auction is paused. The eviction is frozen. It feels like a shield.
Feels like, but isn't.
The stay is temporary. The lender can file what's called a motion for relief from the automatic stay. They're asking the bankruptcy court for permission to continue the foreclosure. And according to U.S. court statistics, these motions are granted in about 90% of cases within 60 days. The court looks at whether the lender's interest in the property is adequately protected, and if you're not making payments, it's not. So the stay buys you time, but not much.
60 days of breathing room for a 90% chance the foreclosure resumes.
if the foreclosure sale has already happened before you file, the automatic stay cannot undo the transfer of title. This is one of the most brutal timing traps in the system. If the auction was last Tuesday and you file bankruptcy on Wednesday, the house is gone. The stay protects property of the bankruptcy estate, but the house isn't yours anymore. It belongs to the buyer at auction.
The lesson is, file before the sale date, not after.
File before the sale date. Timing is everything. Now, Chapter 13 is a different animal. Chapter 13 is a reorganization bankruptcy. You propose a repayment plan that lasts 3 to 5 years. You can use it to cure mortgage arrears over time, while staying current on ongoing payments. If the court confirms your plan, you keep the house. But there's a catch.
There's always a catch.
You need sufficient income to fund the plan. You have to show the court you can make the ongoing mortgage payments plus a portion of the arrears each month. If you lost your job or your income dropped, Chapter 13 might not be feasible. And if you can't fund the plan, the case gets dismissed and the foreclosure resumes. So bankruptcy can save your house, but only if you have enough income to make the math work.
For a lot of people in default, the whole reason they're in default is that the math stopped working.
Now let's talk about possessions and bankruptcy, because this is where things get genuinely counterintuitive. In Chapter 7, you don't just get to keep everything. The bankruptcy trustee, a court-appointed official, has the power to seize and sell your non-exempt personal property to pay your creditors. So even though the mortgage lender can't take your TV, the bankruptcy trustee can.
So filing bankruptcy to stop foreclosure might cost you your furniture and your laptop?
In some states, yes. Each state has its own exemption system, the list of property you're allowed to keep. Texas has an unlimited homestead exemption for your primary residence, which protects your house equity, but the personal property exemption caps at $50,000 for an individual. Florida has a famously generous homestead exemption, but a shockingly low personal property exemption, $1,000.
$1,000 total for everything you own that is in your house.
Your clothes, your kitchen table, your computer, your books. If the total value of your personal property exceeds the exemption, the trustee can take and sell the non-exempt items. Now, in practice, trustees often don't bother with low-value household goods. The cost of seizing and selling a used couch isn't worth it. But a high-end laptop? A valuable musical instrument? A collection of anything? Those are fair game.
The borrower in Florida, who files Chapter 7 to stop foreclosure, might save the house for 60 days while the stay is active, lose the house anyway when the stay is lifted, and lose their laptop and guitar to the trustee in the meantime.
That's the gap. The system has two separate legal processes, foreclosure law and bankruptcy law, and they don't coordinate with each other. They were designed to solve different problems. Foreclosure law is designed to let the lender recover its collateral efficiently. Bankruptcy law is designed to give the debtor a fresh start by liquidating non-exempt assets and discharging debts. The point where they intersect is where borrowers fall through the cracks.
The discharge at the end of Chapter 7. The mortgage debt is gone, but so is the house.
The discharge eliminates personal liability for the mortgage debt. That's meaningful. In a recourse state, like Massachusetts or Virginia, the lender can sue you for the deficiency after foreclosure. If the house sells for $200,000 and you owe $250,000, they can come after you for the remaining $50,000. A Chapter 7 discharge wipes that out, but it doesn't give you the house back. You get a fresh start, no debt, no lawsuit, but also no home.
Non-recourse states are different?
In non-recourse states, California, Arizona, Washington, and a handful of others, the lender cannot pursue a deficiency judgment on a primary residence after a non-judicial foreclosure. The loan is secured solely by the property. If the property isn't enough, the lender eats the loss. That's the trade-off built into the system. Non-recourse states have faster foreclosure timelines. Recourse states give the lender more collection rights.
In a non-recourse state, there's less reason to file bankruptcy at all. At least for the mortgage debt.
Unless you have other debts. Credit cards, medical bills, personal loans, bankruptcy might still make sense for those. But for the mortgage specifically, if you're in California and you're willing to walk away, the lender can't chase you for the difference. The foreclosure itself is the end of it.
Let's talk about what happens after the lockout. We've covered the legal mechanics. Now the uncomfortable question, what happens to the people?
The safety net is patchwork at best. In the U.S., the primary federal foreclosure prevention program was the hardest hit fund, created after the 2008 crisis. It provided billions to the hardest hit states for mortgage payment assistance, principal reduction, and transition assistance. It expired in 2020. The Emergency Rental Assistance Program from the pandemic era was mostly depleted by 2023. As of now, only 14 states have dedicated foreclosure prevention programs with active funding.
14 out of 50.
The funding levels are modest. Most programs offer one-time grants or short-term loans to cover a few months of mortgage payments. They're designed to bridge a temporary hardship, a job loss that lasts 6 months, not a structural affordability problem. They don't help if you're chronically underwater or if your income permanently dropped.
What about the UK?
The UK has the Mortgage Rescue Scheme, which offers equity loans to reduce the principal balance, and the Support for Mortgage Interest Loan, which helps cover interest payments for people on certain benefits. But the uptake is shockingly low. In 2025, according to UK government data, the Mortgage Rescue Scheme helped about 1,200 households. Meanwhile, there were 12,000 repossessions. That's a 10-to-1 ratio.
1,200 helped. 12,000 lost their homes.
The Support for Mortgage Interest Loan is a loan, not a grant. It accrues interest and has to be repaid when the house is eventually sold. So it's not a safety net in the sense of preventing loss. It's a delay mechanism that adds to the eventual bill.
What actually happens to people after eviction? Where do they go?
A 2025 Urban Institute study tracked post-foreclosure households and found that 23% experienced homelessness within 12 months, almost 1 in 4. The rest doubled up with family or friends, moved into lower quality rental housing, often in worse neighborhoods with longer commutes, or in some cases, relocated to entirely different metro areas.
23% is a staggering number.
It's probably an undercount. The study tracked people who had a forwarding address or a credit file that showed rental activity. People who disappear into shelters or couch surf without a paper trail don't show up in the data. The true homelessness rate is likely higher.
This is where bankruptcy complicates things. Because a foreclosure on your credit report plus a bankruptcy filing makes you radioactive to landlords.
Most landlords run credit checks. A foreclosure and a bankruptcy together are about the worst combination you can have. It signals both inability to pay and legal discharge of debts. Many landlords simply won't rent to you, or they'll demand a larger security deposit, or a cosigner, or 6 months of rent up front. Things that someone who just lost their house usually can't provide.
The system produces a person who is legally debt-free but practically unhousable.
That's the paradox at the center of all this. The legal system gives them a fresh start on paper. The housing market treats them as toxic, and there's no bridge between the two.
Let's shift to the practical side. If someone is listening to this and they're facing default, or they know someone who is, what should they actually do?
Three things that the system doesn't tell you. First, do not move out voluntarily until the sheriff lockout. I can't emphasize this enough. If you abandon the property before the foreclosure sale, you may waive your right to surplus proceeds from the auction. If the foreclosure auction results in a sale price higher than the loan balance, which can happen if a third-party bidder shows up and bids above the credit bid, the excess money belongs to the former owner. It's called surplus funds. In some states, it can be thousands or even tens of thousands of dollars. But if you've already moved out and the court deems the property abandoned, you might forfeit that right. Stay until the sheriff tells you to leave.
That's counterintuitive. Most people think leaving early shows cooperation.
The system doesn't reward cooperation, it rewards procedural compliance. Second actionable item, if you're going to file bankruptcy, file before the foreclosure sale date. Once the sale is recorded, the automatic stay cannot undo the transfer. You need to file while you still own the house. Even if you ultimately can't save it, the stay buys you time. Time to plan, time to save money, time to find somewhere to go. Know your state's personal property exemptions. If you file Chapter 7, you can protect essential belongings by claiming exemptions, but you have to list everything and affirmatively assert the exemption. If you stay silent, you waive it. And the exemption amounts vary wildly. In Florida, with that $1,000 cap, you might want to sell or gift valuable items before filing. In Texas, with $50,000 in personal property protection, you're in much better shape. This is not something to navigate without a lawyer.
The three things. Don't leave early. File bankruptcy before the sale, and know what your state lets you keep.
The meta lesson underneath all three is that the system is designed to be efficient for lenders, not humane for borrowers. The rules exist, they're knowable, but nobody tells you about them until you're already inside the machine.
Let's pull back for a minute. What's the broader picture here? Why does this system work the way it does?
Because housing is treated legally as an asset to be liquidated, not a human need. A mortgage is a contract, and the foreclosure process is contract enforcement. Everything flows from that. The lender's interest is in recovering the collateral efficiently. The borrower's interest is in staying housed. Those two interests are not symmetrical in the law. The lender gets a fast, streamlined process. The borrower gets a set of procedural hurdles.
The safety nets that are supposed to catch people, the prevention programs, the rental assistance. They're underfunded, and they require navigating two separate legal systems simultaneously.
Foreclosure and bankruptcy are entirely separate areas of law with different courts, different judges, different rules, and different timelines. A borrower in trouble has to deal with both at once. The county civil court for the eviction, the federal bankruptcy court for the discharge, plus whatever state housing agency runs the prevention programs. It's a full-time job just to understand what's happening, and most people in foreclosure are also dealing with whatever caused the default in the first place. Job loss, medical crisis, divorce.
The people who need the system to work most clearly are the ones least equipped to navigate its complexity.
That's not a bug. It's a feature of a system optimized for lender efficiency. The complexity is not accidental. It's the result of decades of legal refinement aimed at making foreclosure faster and cheaper for banks. Every procedural shortcut, every summary judgment mechanism, every waiver of borrower defenses, it all serves the goal of moving property through the pipeline quickly.
Let me ask you something forward-looking. Should mortgage debt be dischargeable in bankruptcy without losing the home? Some economists argue for what's called a cram-down provision, letting bankruptcy judges reduce the principal to the current market value.
Cram-down already exists for investment properties. If you own a rental property and you file Chapter 13, the bankruptcy judge can reduce the secured portion of the loan to the property's current value and treat the rest as unsecured debt. But for primary residences, it's explicitly prohibited. The bankruptcy code treats your home differently from any other piece of real estate you own. The stated reason is that allowing cram-down on primary residences would destabilize the mortgage market. Lenders would price in the risk of court-ordered principal reduction, which would raise interest rates for everyone. The unstated reason is that the mortgage banking lobby has fought every attempt to change this for 30 years.
The one piece of property that matters most to a family, their home, gets the least legal protection in bankruptcy.
That's the irony. The bankruptcy code will let you cram down a car loan, a rental property, even a vacation home, but not the roof over your head.
Let's look ahead. You mentioned remote work reshaping housing markets. How does that connect to foreclosure risk?
During 2020 through 2022, a lot of people moved from expensive coastal cities to secondary markets. Boise, Austin, Phoenix, Tampa. They bought houses at elevated prices fueled by low interest rates and pandemic demand. Now those markets are correcting. Interest rates are higher. If someone bought a house in Boise for $500,000 in 2021 and it's now worth $400,000, they're underwater. They can't sell without bringing cash to closing. And if they lose their remote job and can't find local work at the same salary, they're stuck with a mortgage they can't afford on a house they can't sell.
The next wave of defaults might look different from the last one.
The 2008 crisis was concentrated in lower-income neighborhoods and subprime borrowers. The next wave could hit middle-class professionals in secondary cities who bought at the peak and are now underwater. People who never expected to be in this situation. People who don't know what an unlawful detainer is or how to claim a personal property exemption.
Which brings us back to where we started. Understanding the mechanics is the first step to navigating the system, or reforming it.
The repossession process is designed to be efficient. It succeeds at that. Whether it's humane is a different question, and one the legal framework doesn't ask. The safety nets are patchwork, underfunded, and hard to access. Bankruptcy can help, but it's a scalpel, not a shield, and if you don't know where to cut, you can make things worse.
If you're listening and you're facing this, the three things again. Don't move out voluntarily, file bankruptcy before the sale date, and learn your state's exemptions. After that, it's a matter of navigating a system that wasn't built with you in mind.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, a fossil collector in the Namib Desert found what he believed to be a preserved giant millipede trackway and proudly displayed it as the earliest evidence of terrestrial arthropod locomotion. A century and a half later, re-examination showed it was actually a series of wind-eroded ripple marks in sandstone that just happened to look like footprints. He had been displaying ancient weather.
A man spent his life showing people fossilized wind. This has been My Weird Prompts, produced by Hilbert Flumingtop, with music by Herman Poppleberry. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.